And you, coming up soon enough, we'll get the lines open so you can join in the conversation about the China study, startling implications for diet, weight loss, and long-term health. Dr. T. Colin Campbell, one of the authors of the book, his son being the other, or I'm at least guessing he's your son by the fact that you share the same last name and he looks an awful lot like you, Dr. Campbell.
That's true. He's our younger son who now is, he was a graduate in theater. And now he's going on to medical school to practice this kind of medicine.
Real quickly, can I ask, who funded this study? Where'd you get the money to do all this?
We got the actual real money to start with from the National Institutes of Health. This was the first joint study between the United States and China. But then at the same time, the Chinese government also put in a lot of effort, a lot of resources, providing something in the neighborhood of around 800 person years worth of professional labor to the study.
Wow.
We also got funding, too, and a lot of resources from the University of Oxford in England and the Imperial Cancer Research Fund.
You make a reference in the book to the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Are you a member of that?
No, I'm not. I have been a scientific advisor to them for some time. I am impressed with some of the work that they've been doing on the question concerning health, but that's my only association is on matters concerning, the design of studies.
Because I think some of this, and it's what I like about how you present the material here, some people feel like that a study like this or information like this is agenda driven from some philosophical or moral viewpoint that said, I don't think anybody should ever be eating meat, so therefore I'm going to find the science that backs that up to get people to, come to my point of view. Would that at all sound like something that you feel like as a doctor or...
Yeah, I know people say that who want to discredit the information, but it's absolutely categorically untrue. I actually, in fact, as you know, used a lot of experimental animal research, and some of the people who espouse those views have that agenda, don't like that kind of me even talking about it.
Right.
So that is totally untrue. It's just, I had no agenda, absolutely none, and I came from the opposite point of view.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I thank you for your patience on those questions. But I think it's important because people like to feel like they're not getting some sort of bait and switch where they've got a doctor who's giving them good advice, but it turns out this is really just all about, manipulating people through information.
Absolutely not. And we spent, as I said before, public money, taxpayer money. It was not commercial money.
I want to ask you about the hospitals. I spent a year as a chaplain intern at an inner city hospital, and I was stunned by what I would have guessed would have been some pretty poor diets or at least poor servings of things brought to people's rooms. I don't know whether they always ate it or what, but I want to ask you about that, about within the medical community, what the perception is about the relationship between what we eat and what is good for us. And then I want to get to more specific questions if I could about hospital food. Can you go down that road with me a little bit?
Sure. Okay. Hospital-based food programs as well as school lunch programs, for example, and another program called Women, Infants, and Children program, the WIC program. I mean, those programs actually are provided food, subsidized food, quite frankly, from the U.S. government. And they operate, for the most part, under policies that are developed by the U.S. government. And so what we tend to see in those institutions like that, schools and hospitals and the like, is a function of what policies have been laid down. And unfortunately, those policies that are being developed are greatly influenced by the food and drug industries, sadly to say. I spent about 20 years myself being on expert panels, so to speak, and advising on the development of policy, so I've seen it from the inside. It's an alarming trend. It's very disturbing, and it's something that the public needs to know more about. And that's why, in part, we get those kinds of programs underway. The second thing is referring to doctors in hospitals. I mean,
yeah.
As you may know, most doctors don't get training in nutrition. They really don't understand it. And so they're less likely to raise questions.
But every so once in a while, I mean, you'll come across a McDonald's in a hospital. And I'm rather fond of McDonald's myself. But, I mean, it always seems odd to me with all this talk about, you know, high-fat diets and stuff, that to have a McDonald's right in a hospital.
That's absolutely, yeah. I think that's most unfortunate, you know, to have that. It's nothing more than for the symbolism that it indicates. It's just a matter of resources, money.
Are you anti-fast food?
No, I mean, if you look at the word fast food, it's a convenience. If you think of it in a convenience sense, sure, we all like to have things of convenience, and in that sense, that's fine. But fast food, unfortunately, is not providing the kind of food that we're talking about here, which happens to be whole foods, whole vegetables, whole grains. I mean, they do have some, you know, orders like that, but
yeah, you can get a good salad.
Reasonably good salad, but many people, as long as they don't, you know, put a big dollop of, you know, dressing, you know, high fat dressing on it, and ruin the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, fast foods are too often made. And that's the other half of this the story, incidentally, is that I often, if you notice, I emphasize whole foods,
right?
Which means that I'm considerably concerned about the use of plant-based constituents like sugar or white flour.
Okay.
You know, I mean, those kinds of foods, the junk foods, are often made up of, you know, products. They may be entirely vegan. They may be entirely vegetarian in nature. But if that means sugar and white flour and oil and, you know, some things like that, that's not what I'm talking about. That's not good.
All right. Well, we'll talk about, if you give up all those things, what could happen to your body? And I think important, a very important chapter in your book is about autoimmune diseases and how they're affected by animal-based protein diets, and what our lives could be like as a culture if we gave up on them. What would happen with our kids? How many years are we really talking about adding to our life in the end, and how it all could help? Next on Coast to Coast AM. I'm so interested in what the China study tells us, but also what Dr. T. Colin Campbell has been writing about the effects of an animal-based protein diet. And of course, as we're discovering, just because I don't eat meat, it apparently doesn't mean I'm really bringing myself all that much benefit, because I still like cheese, and I've tried a lot of the soy cheeses, and I think they're terrible. Just awful. There's one or two of the soy cheeses that are good, but man, most of them are terrible. And I've tried to drink soy milk, and I don't know, it doesn't work for me. But you're giving me new inspiration to try again. But I'm rather fond of my, you know, glass or two a day of skim milk. But now I'm finding, you know, that I'm still opening myself up to, for example, autoimmune diseases. And so let's run down the list again for people who are just tuning in of all of the different diseases that might be affected by the things that are in milk or meat. Could you go? We're talking about like prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, all the Western cancers.
Osteoporosis.
Well, see, then that screws up right there, because we're supposed to drink milk to fight off osteoporosis.
I know, and that largely is due to a very effective marketing campaign over some years. It was greatly influenced by the dairy industry. I have to say that. We now know and have known for a long time that high milk intake, high calcium intake, high animal protein intake, which comes from dairy, is associated with increased risk of osteoporosis, not the reverse.
How could that happen? It's supposed to be about, you know, vitamin D and calcium.
Well, that's, as I say, when the dairy industry has, as I think it was in the past year or so, something like $160 some million to advertise their product. And, you know, those of us who are involved in this work don't even have a penny on the dollar of that, you know, that kind of funding to do this kind of thing. In other words, there's a tremendous influence of the dairy industry on policy development. That's a huge story in itself that the public needs to know. So osteoporosis is something, you know, the different cancers, as I said, colon cancer, heart disease. Heart disease is very much influenced by the consumption of this kind of diet, animal-based foods. diabetes, autoimmune diseases you just mentioned before, rheumatoid arthritis, of course, lupus, even some of the diseases you would never expect to be associated with diet are, in fact, associated with diet, things like cataracts and macular degeneration, which is a chief cause of blindness in older people, is my understanding, and Alzheimer's disease. I mean, we're talking about a whole array of what would seem to be disparate kinds of diseases.
Well, what isn't then? I mean, what isn't affected by what other things that could go wrong aren't associated with animal-based protein diets?
Vitality.
Yeah.
Vitality in the sense of, you know, feeling energetic and being active physically. That's something that's not about disease, but it's about if one is eating a good diet, we're now knowing that you can get better athletic performance, more endurance. This has been shown by some world-class athletes, some of whom I've had to my class at Cornell, you know, who eat this way and achieve these remarkable records that they do by eating that way.
Well,
that's been known a long time.
What about athletes that, they've got to keep their bulk up. They're doing a lot of weightlifting. My sister-in-law was a vegetarian for 20 years. I mean, from the time I met her, when I was a teenager to just not too long ago, she was a vegetarian. But she got into weightlifting, and her training and stuff, she really so much enjoyed it. And the only way she felt like she could get those types of dense proteins was through animal consumption, so she stopped being a vegetarian.
That's true. Incidentally, animal protein-based foods will allow bulking of muscle. There's no question about that. However, what we really need to think about is long-term health for those people. I was told by Dave Scott, who was once called the world's greatest athlete, who was in our class, that in the National Football League, the age of death amongst NFL linemen who bulk up on protein, if you will,
right,
their average age of death is in the early 50s. I don't know whether those figures still hold up or not, but he called it the best-kept secret. So maybe I'm overspeaking the statement, but that's what he said.
Couldn't it just be from drugs and hookers
getting shot at? Yeah, so something like that. But the fact is that when people, like they, consume these enormous amounts of high animal protein-based diets, they get the bulk, yes, and that in the short term is an advantage, I guess. But it turns out that we now know that people who don't do that, instead of getting bulk, they get better muscle tone, more endurance, and certainly better long-term health.
But that would seem to contradict something I read in the book that said that plant-based proteins are nearly as effective as conveying, you know, that type of benefit to your body as meat-based proteins. And I was reading it on one of the charts about kind of comparing animal-based proteins versus plant-based proteins, and it looked fairly comparable.
Yeah, they can be, because keep in mind, you know, any one plant protein, we all know, is maybe a little bit low in one of the amino acids that allows it not to be used as efficiently as an animal-based food or an animal-based protein. So on a one-on-one basis, that plant proteins, you know, they don't have the same bang for the buck as a plant, as an animal protein on the one hand. But on the other hand, we consume a mixture of plant proteins, that each of which tend to compensate whatever deficiencies the other may have. And at the same time, when we're doing that, we're consuming the whole food, and we're getting all the antioxidants and fiber and all the rest of it. So, you know, we're getting long-term health.
Okay.
It comes back to the question concerning, you know, the holistic effects of all the food and all the stuff that's in it.
Well, looking at the China study and learning what we can from it, startling implications for diet, weight loss, and long-term health. Dr. T. Colin Campbell is our guest, and we're talking about all of the different ways in which our lives would change if we had a different diet. I will tell you, and this is my own testimony, and I have absolutely no medical research to back this up, but I have wanted to mention this a couple of times in this conversation, so I'll just get it out now, is I have been a long-term sufferer of eczema, and I have the worst kind of eczema, apparently, and it's most prevalent in my hands, and so bad has it been in the past that at least on two occasions I've had to go to a hospital when I've had a huge flare-up, a huge breakup, and I've gotten what they call degloved a couple of times, where the eczema was so bad, as you know, degloving, it just, you know, essentially all of the skin on my hands came off, and I had to grow almost new skin. It was really horrid. I mean, so I stopped eating meat last December, and I have, I mean, with the exception of one or two little moments, and they were nothing by comparison, I've had almost no eczema for a year. And I keep telling people I think it's related to, you know, the cessation of meat, but I have nothing to back that up. What do you think?
Well, I tell you, take one, there's a great story that you're just telling, and I'm not surprised, but I tell you to take one more step, and that's to eliminate the dairy you're consuming, because it's likely to be more of a problem than even the meat.
Really? Because I just haven't had any problems.
Well, okay, then you certainly got a big advantage, you know, by cutting out some of the problem. But and maybe it's enough in this particular case. But we do know that dairy, you know, it creates these immunological responses, including, you know, things like acne and other disorders like that, maybe eczema. But
well, it was true for me. I just can't do soy milk. Are you a soy milk drinker?
No, I can't drink soy milk
either.
Okay. That's not where I'm going.
Good.
And I'm just simply saying, you know, to avoid the dairy. I mean, I used to use milk on my cereal, for example. I don't use any kind of milk of any kind on my cereal.
What do you pour in your cereal now? Beer?
No. It's a plant-based extract. It might work, but no, I don't do that. But
don't have cereal anymore.
No, I have hot cereal every morning. What my wife does, we pick a lot of fresh fruit and freeze it. We just put that in the bottom of the cereal bowl, you know, melt it just, you know, put it in the microwave just enough to sort of melt it down a little bit, put some hot cereal on the top of it, put some maybe a little maple syrup on it, some brown sugar a little bit maybe, raisins, other fruit.
But no
delicious
butter.
Delicious dish.
No butter.
No butter.
Okay, do you put margarine? Can you have margarine?
No. No, we don't use that either.
But could I have margarine?
Well, it's not that much difference between that and butter, to be honest about it.
Vegetable oil.
Well, of course, vegetable. I mean, yeah, margarine comes from vegetable oil, but what has happened is the vegetable oil itself is an oil. It's not, you know, it's not in a solid form like margarine. And the way they convert it from an oil to a solid is by hydrogenating it, and therefore you get the trans fats.
I give up. I totally give up.
And here's the question. You know, we're all prisoners of our taste preferences,
okay,
especially of recent past. And if we begin to change our diet and do it fairly thoroughly, once you discover, and I can speak from personal experience, and my family can too, and many other people, when you do this and you do it for long enough, all of a sudden you discover altogether new tastes, and you wonder, how in the world did I ever eat that stuff that I used to eat? And you just can't go back.
Well,
you know, if you do it thoroughly, if a vegetarian, most vegetarians are still on dairy and eggs and stuff like that, they never get to that point, so they can't tell.
Well, why can't people just supplement their diet with more pills or more powders or something like that to help bring about the good effects?
Well, that's taking nutrients out of context. You know, it's taking a single nutrient, and I must tell you, that's one of the principles that, you know, we were developing over the years that I've become impressed with, and that is that in food, we've got thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of different kinds of chemicals all working in symphony, working together to produce the response. And the mere thought of taking just one thing at a time like that and assuming that we're going to better nature by doing that, it's really it's a very superficial idea and makes money. You know, it makes but now we know, we have evidence after using these single nutrient supplements, for example, that they have essentially no effect, no beneficial effect on long-term health.
Okay.
In the short term, they look, you know, they look pretty good at times, but in terms of long-term health is what we're interested in. They don't work.
All right. Interesting stuff. It's the China study, the most comprehensive study of nutrition ever conducted. I guess we should get back to some more of the China study, although there's this other question that's lingering out there about animal-based proteins and what's happening to young girls. And I want to pick up that question coming up with Dr. T. Colin Campbell. It's just something that I've been hearing more and more about. Girls reaching puberty at like age, you know, 8. And some people say it's the hormones that are in the milk from the cows. But now I'm wondering whether it has something to do with just the milk itself. We'll ask Dr. Campbell about that. We'll get your questions coming up too on Coast to Coast AM. Talking with Dr. T. Colin Campbell, the book is The China Study. We'll get to your questions at the top of the hour. We'll open up the phones then. And I don't know, earlier I was referring to this as sort of radical alternative nutrition. From my perspective, at least, that's kind of where it sits. How do you feel about that description?
I don't like the word alternative anymore.
Okay.
It was an interesting idea in the beginning to talk about something different than traditional, but unfortunately, anything that's called alternative these days is oftentimes pushed aside as something a little bit strange, a little bit different, maybe not mainstream kind of thing.
So what would you rather call it?
I don't know what to call it, to be honest, but I don't have a good answer. But I think this ought to be considered to be normal nutrition. This is healthy nutrition. This is optimal nutrition, essentially. And because the one thing that we haven't talked about, Ian, is, as my own research career unfolded and I started, getting more confident in this view, I ran across some clinics in this country, run by physicians, fully qualified, very distinguished physicians who are using this kind of information, have been using this kind of information to do some dramatic things with people. And I've seen it with my own eyes, like reversing heart disease, as opposed to, going to the hospital and getting bypass surgery. I mean, the results that some people are now getting by doing this kind of thing are absolutely staggering.
All right.
We're talking about using diet to cure diseases, not just prevent them, but cure them.
Why don't we call it then a preventative nutrition?
We could do that.
It sounds kind of boring, though, too, doesn't it?
Yes, it's kind of a husky word. And
therapeutic nutrition.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. That's awesome. I don't know. Maybe together between us we can come up with something, but optimal nutrition sounds a little boring too. But
all right, if I ate a perfect diet, I mean perfectly, if I read, your book every page and I jotted down everything and I came up with the perfect diet, how old might I live to?
Oh, it's a good question, but it's not so much how old we live, it's allowing us to live a full length of life, free of problems. That's okay. The first thing. But let's set that aside and get to your question. There is a study that's been ongoing now for some time where they've been following people who are more or less doing the right thing. Not as well as they could, but they're mostly vegan for at least some portion of their lives. The evidence is indicating that they're living 10 years longer, 10 to 12 years longer. So, I mean, we do see changes in, length of life.
Okay.
As a result of this. So and much less of these diseases.
If the typical American male, Caucasian male, lives to 73, I might live to 83. I might expect to live healthfully and happily to 83.
Right, or longer, of course.
Okay. I might die in a bungee cord accident or something like that. I mean, that sounds facetious, but I'm not being. I mean, I live such an active life that, right. I might. Have other many other problems. I might be more at risk from accidents than from disease at a certain level in my life.
Yeah, you'd like to maybe play some tennis or some golf or something until you're in your 90s, wouldn't you?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess it comes right down to then is what do I have to give up in order to do this? Because you say the word vegan, and I'm like so allergic to that word. I mean,
so
because I associate that with this kind of persnickety, really judgmental. Kind of diet program where people just you shouldn't eat that, man, and it's just all that stuff. And I
hear you.
Okay, so
yeah, I totally hear you and I agree with you, and I'm from the same area. I try to kind of avoid the V words because they carry a lot of baggage with them, and it's not to discount what those folks do or any of the reasons for doing so, I think, but that's why I like the word sort of plant-based. I think it's a little more comfortable.
Yeah, it makes you sound like a brontosaurus, though. I'm with you, but I mean, I guess there isn't any other way to make it cool. I heard an interesting story this week about comedian Richard Lewis. Do you know who he is? Funny guy. But he said he was backstage at a Rolling Stones concert, and he was really looking forward to meeting the guys in the Rolling Stones, or some people calling them these days the Strolling Bones. And so he's backstage and he sees Keith Richards, and he just as Richard Lewis is sampling something from one of those backstage, buffet platters, he's putting some cheese in his mouth And Keith Richards comes up to him and says, "Hey, man, you shouldn't eat cheese. It'll kill you." That's coming from Keith Richards, who's smoking his body weight in marijuana and other things for years. So, I mean, I look at that and I think, I guess, you know, somehow Keith Richards is surviving. Is the secret of him defying the odds at this point the fact that he doesn't eat dairy?
Right. I mean, the information is gradually seeping out there. I've seen it during my lifetime, and there's more and more people coming on board with this. And what's really exciting is not so much what we have to give up, it's what we gain.
Okay.
You know, that's the way I look at it. And I've gained a lot. I mean, I've seen other people who do this thing, and if they do it the right way, that's the key. They've got to do it the right way.
How old are you?
I'll be 72 in 3 months, and I still run 4 to 6 miles every morning, and I'm probably 50 pounds, I guess, now, 50, 55 pounds less than I was when I came out of graduate school.
Okay, and so when you see other 72-year-olds, do you have a lot of 72-year-old friends? What kind of shape are they in?
Not in as good a shape as that. I mean, others will tell me that. I mean, the doctors say that, too. Gosh, you're really young-looking, you're healthy-looking, et cetera, et cetera. Not to brag, but, I mean, just to answer your question, other people my age and younger are having a lot of difficulties.
Yeah.
One of the greatest bits of motivation I get when I think about this is walking into an old age home and seeing maybe some friends or something like that and seeing all these people in there who are suffering, who are needlessly. I mean, that really moves me. And they didn't know. It's not that they did anything really wrong. They really didn't know. And the information is not getting out there.
Wouldn't it totally suck, though, if next year after all of this, I mean, God forbid, and I'm knock on wood and anything else you want, wouldn't it be terrible if next year you got cancer or something like that? And then how would you understand your, you know, development of that with all that you've given up in order to avoid it?
How would I understand it?
How would you understand it?
Yeah, well, first off, this particular form that we're talking about is not going to eliminate all of the cancer, for starters. I mean, if I were to get it, or somebody like me were to get it, let's say at age 75, and we're still doing all the right thing, it may be because, and we have good evidence for this, they would have otherwise got the disease when they were 45, now they're 75.
Okay.
So in other words, it's got the whole thing. I mean, we got a lot of evidence for that.
Okay, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Cool.
Well, it's probably very true.
All right. When we come back, I want to ask you what's in your refrigerator.
Okay. Well, let me go and open the door and look.
Okay. You do that. Because, I mean, honestly, if I'm going to eat like you, I want to know what's in your fridge.
Well, I should get my wife on it. She's the one that knows the best. But I'll look and I'll
okay.
tell you in a few minutes.
We'll come right back. Dr. T. Colin Campbell, the China study, all the things that could happen to your life health-wise, good, if you gave up animal-based proteins in either milk or meat, and we'll start getting your calls coming up next hour. But we'll find out just what would happen if you did, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other diseases and the relationship with that and milk and meat next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Getting your questions coming up next hour for Dr. T. Colin Campbell. So you had a chance to peruse your refrigerator. And if you're telling everybody as a result of the China study and your career in looking into the health implications of animal-based protein, that their lives would be better if they gave up meat and milk, then let me ask you, what's in your fridge?
Lots of produce and some rice milk. A little soy milk my wife uses in cooking. And incidentally, on the question concerning cooking, she actually makes pastries these days, or, you know, muffins and things like that. They're just so delicious. She just takes regular recipes. You can get it in any cookbook, and she just has really learned how to modify them. And in the case of making things like that, she just doesn't use any oil or fat.
What about eggs?
She cuts down no eggs. She hasn't used that for years.
Okay, don't have any eggs.
No.
What about like egg beaters? What about something like that?
No, she doesn't do that either.
What about you?
She uses fruit, you know, sort of blended. What do you call it? You grind it, you put it in a blender like bananas.
Sure, like a smoothie right?
Yeah, or prunes or something like that. I mean, that she puts that in place of fat, and that gives a good consistency to the, you know, to the baked goods.
Okay, but you never have a good omelet. You know,
no,
you don't have.
I used to like omelets, and you know, I don't do that. No.
Even though they're low, I mean, if you get something like an egg substitute, they're totally low in cholesterol.
We did it for a while, but no, we don't do that.
Okay. Well, why? I mean, just out of curiosity. I mean, why would that? Because I've been going cholesterol-free in my eggs for a long time, and I feel like that's helped me.
Well, you know, my wife is just, let me ask her if she ever used it. Just a second.
Okay.
Do you ever use egg
beaters? I love
that. She said no, she doesn't do that right now.
Okay. All right. Let me ask you a question, okay? When was the last time you had a plate of French fries?
I haven't ordered a plate of French fries in at least 10 years.
Okay.
But I have to say, one of our grown children occasionally gets some, and I've reached over his plate when we're in a restaurant, and he said, hey, give me one of those.
Okay.
You know, something like that. But I haven't ordered any myself.
Okay. So you've pilfered somebody else's French fries recently.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. That's all right. See, this happens. My wife does this all the time. She'll go, oh, no, I can't have any. But then she'll have some of mine, and then she'll end up eating all of them. All right. Then, and what about, like, Cocoa Krispies or anything like any junk food that you have at all? Do you have any guilty pleasures at all?
No, I mean, occasionally I've had some candy, but gosh, I have very little of that. Some hard candies, maybe. What else?
Okay. But I mean,
that's about it. No more donuts. I haven't had donuts. I used to love them. I mean, they're so high in fat. Anything that I eat has even got hidden fat in it. I mean, I can feel the feel in my mouth and taste of it. I don't like it.
Okay.
Because my taste preferences have changed.
All right. So, but you don't have any guilty pleasures where it's just like you treat yourself to a, and then fill in the blank.
Oh, gosh. I've done that. I'm just trying to think what I did. I travel a lot, and I just got something just the other day. What did I get? During airports, you can't get much of good things.
Right.
And I had a... some kind of pastry, forget what it was, and I got done, and just what I said, that
didn't feel good.
That taste. Yeah, I said, geez, what did I eat that thing for?
So like cheesecake out of the question.
Yes, out of the question.
Okay,
yeah.
Out of the question. All right. Well, this is helpful, and I appreciate your patience with this, because I think people are trying to get an idea of what life would be like without it. And it's hard to imagine, you know, food without pleasure in the sense that carbs and fat in diet often brings. And so, you know, are there any fats in your diet? Aren't we supposed to have some of them just for our own joint health?
Of course, we have to have some fat. There's no question about that. We have some of them are essential, and you can get that by consuming nuts. You also get a little bit of fat, of course, you know, just out of grains, not much, but you get some. So you get enough.
That's the
point.
I worked at a period of time briefly with a guy named Harry Carey, the old baseball announcer. You know the guy I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I happened to work with him at a radio station at the time that he had gotten this diagnosis about his own health, and it wasn't looking good for Harry Carey. And he asked the doctor at the time, he said, if I gave up on all the things he was supposed to give up, cigars, alcohol, fatty foods, he said, how much would I actually be adding to my life? And the doctor said to him, you know, probably 6 months to 2 years if you gave up on all of those things. And he said, well, forget that. And he went and just said, well, that's not worth the trade-off. What can you assure people who would give up these things if they actually followed the China study, if they gave up on all of these animal-based proteins in their diet, what absolutely could you say they would start to feel the effects in right away? What measurable improvement in their life would that bring, say within, you know, 6 weeks or 3 months of giving up those products?
Well, first off, I wouldn't use the word assure.
Okay.
You know, because you know, all I can talk about is greatly reducing the odds of getting you know, unpleasant effects, or greatly increasing the odds of getting some good effects, like, you know, increased vitality, increased energy, losing weight, you know, reducing blood sugars, reducing cholesterol levels, that's important. I mean, these kinds of things can be seen very early on, and if it turns out that too, if you've got somebody who's, let's say, got a little bit of angina, you know, getting into pretty serious stages of heart disease, I have a very good friend, very distinguished surgeon. He was one of the top 100 doctors in the United States, who actually takes people like that, and in no time, in just a matter of days, a week or so, he can switch them over to a diet like this and get rid of their angina. And these are people who are being encouraged to go get bypass surgeries. I mean, it's an amazing story of what he's able to do with these people. And so it all depends on what kind of person you're talking about, what kind of benefits they get. I mean, if they're experiencing problems, maybe they're experiencing, you know, allergic kinds of problems, and they'll see relief from that. Maybe they're in a diabetic condition and they're high blood sugar, so they'll see that disappear. Maybe they're getting rheumatoid arthritis, and if they go off dairy. I was just recently, just last week, in fact, with someone who walked into a clinic 2 weeks before, was hardly able to walk. She had been for some years really crippled with rheumatoid arthritis. 2 weeks later, it was amazing. She was walking out of there freely with almost no pain. I mean, I see these kind of things, you know, and I just shake my head. I say, how in the world, you know, can this kind of information, you know, not be out there being told to the public? It's criminal.
Well, and some people said that there's a link between girls going into early physical development or puberty as a result of dairy products. Where are you with that?
Yeah, that's in fact, it's really quite true. In China, for example, this is from, go back to our China study, the average age of the first menstrual period in China was 17 years. 17 years. The average age in this country at the time we were doing the studies around 11, 12 years. It might be a little bit lower now. But in any case, the age at menarche, or the age of first menstruation, is a function of how fast the young girl is growing. And if she's going to be consuming the typical Western diet, high in animal protein, high in fat, and so forth, she's going to grow a little bit faster, imperceptibly faster maybe in some cases, but she's going to be pushing her growth rate, in which case then she gets age, you know, she starts her menstrual period earlier. And once anyone, any young woman gets into that period, their estrogen levels go up. And in the Western woman, the estrogen levels go much higher than they do, you know, in someone starting later. And those high estrogen levels then are sustained for a longer period of time because that kind of woman then will end, the Western woman, that is, will end up, you know, reaching menopause later. So she ends up, the Western woman will have about 8 to 9 years longer reproductive life. And during that time have about 40 to 50% higher female hormone levels, all of which just plays into a higher risk of breast cancer. I mean, it's beginning to be a very clean story, and dairy is one of the things that will really do that. It'll do it big time.
And yet, again, it's one of the things that parents give their kids because we believe that this is good for them and that the benefits outweigh the problems.
Yeah, and the benefits that most people sort of hear about, probably, as far as dairy is concerned, is supposedly it makes strong bones and teeth. You've heard that probably all your life.
Sure, and hair.
You know, yeah, and it reduces osteoporosis. The reverse is true. People consuming the most dairy have the highest risk, you know, for osteoporosis. It's simply, that's been known for a long time, according to some of the information we have. But that's a matter of, you know, who has the most financial muscle, you know, to talk to the public about that.
You know, I got to say, though, I mean, as a vegetarian over the last year, I found almost nothing good to eat when I was at the state fair. The only thing I could have was cheese curds drenched in ketchup, and that was pretty awesome. But
that's
now you're saying I can't even have that.
Yeah, I used to go to the state fairs and take my calf there and show the calf, and I don't go there now because there's nothing to eat.
There's nothing to eat. You can't eat anything, can you? Can't have ice cream.
Pardon?
I said you can have popcorn.
Yeah, I used to love ice cream, but I had to give that up some years ago.
So do you have anything like an ice cream product? Do you have soy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
What my wife does is really good. She takes bananas, for example, and cuts them a little chunk, you know, especially when they get a little soft. So she sticks them in a Ziploc bag, puts them in a freezer, freezes them up. And when we're a nice, cold, creamy kind of dessert, she throws them into a blender.
Okay.
And it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. She can take other kinds of fruits and do the same thing. And, you know, smoothies and things like that are always great.
Sure. All right. Well, very good. Well, it's a matter then of having an optimum health diet, and all of the diseases that would be eliminated, and some of the greatest health challenges to our country and our health care system could just be reduced by up to 90%, says Dr. T. Colin Campbell. We'll get back to the China study with your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.